Okay, if you want to grab your Bibles and go to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, that's where we will be today. We've got two classes left in this study. We'll cover chapter 2 today, cover chapter 3 next week, and then that will be the end of our study session on this particular on these two particular books. I hope this has been helpful for you in your studies. There's a lot of information in these books, and a whole lot more than we can study in 45 minutes on a Sunday morning. But hopefully you spend time studying on your own and getting into them and trying to dig in for your own furtherance of your knowledge and the building of your faith. But we're in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, and we studied the first book, and now we're in the second book. And just a reminder of where we are in these books, these are the first two books that we know of that Paul wrote of his epistles that we have in the New Testament. These are the earliest ones. Written on his second missionary journey, written just a few months after, apparently, after he had left the city of Thessalonica. He had to leave earlier than he wanted to leave because of the persecution. And so he writes the first letter back to them within a few months. And the real central idea among these two epistles is just the second coming of Jesus. And he deals with the second coming in his first letter to them, talking about the hope and comfort that Christians can have as they face the second coming. And then he gets word after they receive that first letter that there's still some misunderstanding. They still are not fully understanding what they need to about the second coming. And so he writes this second letter, helping them to understand the necessary preparations that they need to be making and the understanding they need to have about the second coming. Can there be some, is the second coming, is that something that people can misunderstand some things about? In our day and age, are there people who misunderstand things about the second coming? And if we're misunderstanding it now, go back to that time when they did not have the completed New Testament that you and I have. They were relying on inspired men. Men, prophets, and others who had spiritual gifts that could impart God's will to them, they're relying on those individuals to teach them. They could not go and just read 1 and 2 Thessalonians to have an understanding about the second coming. Those books didn't exist yet. And so they've got to understand this from Paul's teachings, from the other inspired men's teaching, and have an understanding of it from there. So they had some confusion on the matter. And so we looked at chapter 1. 2 weeks ago, and how Paul talked about the second coming of Jesus and encouraged them in regard to it and tried to bring these Christians comfort, although those who are not Christians, he said, would suffer everlasting destruction in verses 8 and 9, away from the presence of the Lord and away from the glory of His power. But we get to chapter 2, and chapter 2 has some parts in it that can be kind of confusing, and not just can be, they are. To us, because we don't have all of the information. And we're going to go through this morning, but just so that you're aware, if you know of this chapter, I'm not going to try to identify for you who the man of lawlessness is. Called the man of lawlessness, the man of sin, and the one who was restraining the man of lawlessness. We're going to talk about that a little bit, but I'm not going to stand here and try to tell you who I believe that was, because I don't believe the Bible tells us who that was, and we'll get into that. And so that brings a little bit of confusion to this study. Is there's some things in this chapter we just don't know, and we don't like that, do we? Do we like to be on the side of something where we don't understand, we don't know, we don't have all of the information? Usually we want all the answers. We want all of the information. We want to know everything there is to know. And when the Bible doesn't tell us everything, well, sometimes we're not satisfied with that. And unfortunately, some people, in their dissatisfaction that the Bible hasn't told us things, they try to go in and fill in the blanks. And I don't think God has given us that right to do that. But let's look at this. Chapter 2. Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, the theme of this letter, and our gathering together to Him. When Jesus comes back, where are we going to gather together to Him? We're going to meet Him in the air. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 17, verse 16 and 17, we are going to meet him in the air. We're going to be gathered together to him in the air when he returns. We're all going to, at that time, appear before him on the day of judgment. But this, I believe, is particularly talking about what's going to transpire as soon as he comes back. We're gathered together with him in the clouds. And here's what he says. Here's what we ask you. Interesting words. Other translations may have the word request or beg. Here's what we're asking you. Verse 2. Not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled. He says, regarding the second coming, I don't want you to be shaken in your mind. I don't want you to be wavering. I don't want you to feel a level where you don't have all of the certainty that you need to have. The word that was used here for shaken was like a, almost like a ship that was being loosed from its moorings. He says, I don't want you to be shaken. I don't want you to be troubled. The idea there is I don't want you to be alarmed or agitated. Now, why would they be shaken or alarmed when it came to the second coming? Well, what does he say in verse 2? Either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come. What's he saying in that verse? There were some individuals, there were some false teachers that were really causing some problems for these Christians. Particularly, there were some individuals that were coming along and trying to get these Christians to believe that Jesus had already come, that the second coming had already transpired. Would that bother you? If you were being led to believe that Jesus had already come and you had missed it, would you be troubled? Would you be shaken in mind? Hello, I'm here. Jesus, hello, you missed me. These people, now, how do we know these are false teachers? Well, first of all, they're teaching something that's false, that the day of Christ had already come. But notice how he says this. I don't want you to be shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter. What does all of that mean? What does the word spirit mean? You might write 1 John chapter 4 and verse 1 if you're trying to figure out what the spirit is. 1 John 4 and verse 1, Jesus, or the Bible says, test all spirits. Do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits, whether they are from God. Well, what does that mean? It's talking about false teachers. It's talking about individuals, talking about these false teachers who had gone out, and God says you need to test all of these people who are teaching you to make sure what they're teaching you is right. So he says, here's some people, and he says, I don't want you to be shaken by these individuals, whether by spirit they've come to you in person and are teaching you, or by word, there's some kind of an oral presentation that they make, or by letter, and this was a common thing apparently in that day, is that a letter might be sent and said, here is a letter from Paul. How do you know if it's a letter from Paul or not? I mean, you're going to check the IP address on his letter and say, okay, let's track this back. Did it come from Paul's IP address? I mean, what's the deal with that? How do they know if it's from Paul or not? They're going to take it to a handwriting expert? You know, forensic expert? All right, let's take it to forensics. Can you compare the loops on his L's with the loops on the L's? Is this the same handwriting? How are they going to know if it's from Paul or not? Could you get a letter that claimed to be from Paul, and you'd be thinking, hey, this could be a letter from Paul. I need to pay attention to this. And so he tells them, look, we know that there are some individuals who are going around, and as if from us, look at that in verse 2, as if they are speaking for us, they're coming to you and they're teaching you in their presence, or they're writing you letters, and here's what they're saying is that the day of Christ had already come. Look in 2 Timothy just for a second to compare this. This was not the only time that this was mentioned. It's mentioned other times. Look in 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 16. Now this is Paul. We've been studying 1st, 2nd Thessalonians, Paul's first letters, written about 51 A.D. 2 Timothy is Paul's last letter before he was put to death, written around somewhere 67 A.D. or something. So we're about 15 or 16 years in between these first and last letters. But 2 Timothy 2 and verse 16, he says, but shun profane and idle babblings, for they will increase to more ungodliness. Stay away from these people and these teachings that have no sense to them. Well, like what? Verse 17. Their message will spread like cancer. Hymenaeus and Philetus are of this sort. They have strayed concerning the truth in verse 18. And what are they teaching? Saying that the resurrection is already past. And they overthrow the faith of some. Well, would that be the case, that the faith of some would be overthrown if these individuals were coming along and saying, the resurrection is already past? Where were you? Were you out on vacation? How did you miss it? And overthrow the faith of some people. So this was something that was going on, and how and why people were believing this, we don't have all the information, but these people were teaching back in 2 Thessalonians verse 2 that the day of Christ either had already come, or it could even be saying that it was right upon them, depending on how the tense is read, but that the day of Christ had already come. So here's what he says in verse 3. Let no one deceive you. I don't want you to be shaken, troubled, or deceived. Let no one deceive you, 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 3, by any means. For that day will not come unless the falling away comes first. And the man of sin and the man of lawlessness is revealed. What is this talking about? Paul says, you are being taught that the day of the Christ has already come. He says, you need to understand it hasn't already come, because there is something that must come before he can come. What must come before Jesus comes? The falling away. Do you have some of you may have the word apostasy there instead of the word falling away, because that's the Greek word apostasia is there. It's talking about that, so they sometimes use the word apostasy there instead. But do you have a word before falling or before apostasy? It's a little one. The. You have a the in front of apostasy or in front of falling away? That's interesting that God put a definite article in front of falling away, in front of apostasy. So Paul is not just saying that there's going to be a falling away. There's going to be a apostasy away from the Lord. But he identifies it as a specific one. Now, which one would that be? And here we begin the part of this passage. We don't have all of the information. We don't have all of the answers. Let's keep reading. And here's what I want us to do. I want us to read from verse 3 down to about maybe about verse 9 or 10. And I want you to just see what he says, and then we'll come back and review this a little bit. And again, I don't want it. My intention this morning is not to dig into this and to give every little answer that can possibly be given. I want you to get an overview of the passage. What is he trying to say to them? He's trying to reassure them in their faith. He's trying to reassure them they haven't missed out on the second coming, because that's what was being taught in verse 2. He's trying to build them up and to give them encouragement and understanding, and also to also give them some instructions and cautions as it regards the second coming. But look in verse 3. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. What is this man of sin, the son of perdition, the perishing one? What is he going to do? Who opposes, verse 4, constantly, and exalts himself constantly above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Sounds like an interesting person. Verse 5. Do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things? That's key. And now you know, that's key, what is restraining. So it's not just that the man of law, he's not just talking about the man of lawlessness who's going to come, but he's also talking about what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. Verse 7. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. That is key. Verse 9. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. What is this talking about? What is he talking about that there's going to be the falling away and that this man of lawlessness or this man of sin is going to be revealed, but he's only going to be revealed after that which is or he who is restraining him is removed? There's been a lot of different ideas that have been suggested over the years as to what or who this is. And I want to try to review some of the characteristics of this man of lawlessness that we've read about in this passage. And again, not to try to identify, but what is it saying about who this person is? It says that he is the ultimate result of the falling away from the faith. First thing that's going to happen before Christ can come, Paul is saying to them, is that before Christ comes, there must be the falling away. And I believe that when he says the falling away, he's identifying to them something he had already talked to them about. Verse 5, what does he say? You know these things. I already told you about these things. So did he already tell them about the falling away? Yeah, he identifies as if to say, you know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the falling away that I talked to you about when I was there. This was something that they were familiar with. And the man of lawlessness was going to be revealed as the ultimate result of that taking place. From Paul's vantage point, when you read this chapter, these events were still yet to be done, yet to be revealed. The man of lawlessness had not yet been revealed, although, and I don't remember which number it is on here, verse number 9, the early stages were already at work. So the man of lawlessness was yet to be revealed. That's yet future, but the workings were already taking place. Number 3, the son of perdition. That's what he's called. The man of lawlessness, comma, the son of perdition. Simply is describing a perishing one perhaps even more who is destined to destruction. He's the one that's eventually going to be destroyed. And we saw down at the end of verse 8 that he's going to be destroyed when Jesus comes. Another characteristic, number 4, he's one in verse 4 who blatantly opposes God. That doesn't sound like a good position to be in, does it? Somebody who blatantly opposes God and everything that is God and His revealed will. Number 5, he not only, in verse 4, he not only opposes God, but he arrogantly exalts himself above all that is called God. Think about someone who would not only oppose God, that's one kind of person, but would oppose God and exalt himself to a position where he would be the one who would be worshipped. He would be the one who would be honored and receive all of the attention. Verse 6, and we don't, or number 6 on the list, it's on in verse 5 or verse 4. In some sense, he would be one who would sit in the temple of God and show himself as God. This does not specifically mean that he would sit in the physical temple. There have been some that have suggested maybe this is talking about the church, since the church is the temple of God. I don't know that it's specifically talking about the church, but I don't think we can identify it as the specific temple in the city of Jerusalem. The word that's used here is specifically talking about it was the word that was used for the sanctuary of the temple, the most holy place. That it may or may not be talking about the literal physical temple itself, but it's somebody who would set himself up as, in other words, receiving worship. In the temple of God, that's where God was worshipped. If you put yourself in that position, what does that mean? You want to be worshipped. Number 7, he's willing to be used as Satan's vehicle. He would be coming, as verse 9 says, coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan. He is Satan's pawn. He is being used in some sense by Satan, which would indicate that this person is probably not Satan himself, because it's someone who is instead coming according to the working of Satan as a separate identity as to whoever that might be. And when he comes, this is interesting in verse 9, he's going to come with power, signs, and lying wonders. Do you remember in Acts 2 when Peter was preaching about Jesus, Jesus, the man of Nazareth, whom God attested to you by miracles and wonders and signs which God did in your midst. Similar phraseology here, except what's the difference? What does it say, Betty? It says lying. Jesus did miracles, wonders, and signs. Were they real? Yeah. Acts chapter 1 says that after he appeared, after his resurrection, he appeared to them by many infallible proofs. This was not something that could be denied. These were obvious. When Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead in John chapter 11, was that something that could be denied? Oh, no, you know, he didn't really raise him from the dead. Yeah, he did. He'd been dead for 4 days. So, he really did. So, Jesus's enemies became so concerned, worried, frustrated, that they not only wanted to put Jesus to death, what else do they want to do in John 11, in John 12? Let's put Lazarus to death. Let's get rid of the evidence. Jesus's miracles were obvious. These works, these things that this lawless one does, they are by power and signs, but they are lying wonders. There is something that is very obvious about them, that they are not real, they are not genuine. You remember Simon the sorcerer in Acts chapter 8? Did he have a lot of people following him, believing what he was doing was real? And then they saw Philip come, and they saw the real deal. And when they saw the real deal, what did they realize about Simon? This guy's a hoax. He's a fake. What he's doing is just trickery. Well, that's what's involved here. But does that still get people to follow, even with the trickery? Yes. Even with these signs and wonders and various things, that's what was happening in verse 10, so that people would follow after, obviously, obviously lead them down a road that would lead to their destruction. I don't remember what number we're on the screen. Verse number 8. Is his prime objective is to deceive God's children. Number 9, we've already looked at that the early stages of this in verse 7 were already at work. And so Paul says this is still something that's in the future, but the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. There was some influence in this verse that was restraining. The lawless one was going to be revealed, but something was holding him back. And if you look in verse 6, I don't know what this means, but something for you to consider. In verse 6, it says, now you know what is restraining. That's neuter. That's not male or female. That's neuter. What is restraining? But if you drop down and look in verse 7, mystery of lawlessness is already work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. And now the restraining portion is put with a masculine pronoun. It's neuter first, it. It's masculine second, he. I don't know what that means. Now, if you've got a Bible that's got the word he capitalized, maybe you've got a he capitalized in verse 7, which has led some people to believe that the one who is restraining, doing the restraining, is God, because God gets the capital letters on the he's, right? Except you might have a footnote. You have a footnote for that takes you to your margin and says maybe it's not capitalized. In the original Greek, there were not capitals and lowercase letters, okay? In fact, there weren't even spaces between words. There were not capitals and lowercase letters. There were not spaces between words. There was not punctuation most of the time. And so anytime there's any capitalization here, these things were put in by the translators, and not all translations are equal as to where they put capitals or not capitals, or even use capitals on the pronouns. So we don't know that it was God who was doing the restraining. These translators, some of them apparently did. But whoever this one is restraining is going to be in place until he is taken out of the way at the end of verse 7. And when he is taken out of the way, the lawless one will be revealed. But the key to everything that Paul is saying here is what he wants them to know at the end of verse 8. When he's revealed, what's going to happen to him? The Lord is going to consume him, slay him, defeat him. Who's going to win this? Who's in charge here? How is Jesus going to consume him? With the breath of his mouth and with the brightness of his coming. Just by his very presence, Jesus is going to destroy the man of lawlessness. Who is this? Well, I'll put these up here just so you can see how many different, and there's more than this, but how many different suggestions, guesses, ideas, proposals have been put forth over the years as to who the man of lawlessness is and who is it that's restraining him. And let me say this, some of these are quite comical. When you get down here and talk about various U.S. presidents being the man of lawlessness, that can be quite comical. And depending on what generation and what decade it was, whoever was the current president, they were the man of lawlessness. You know, and another way of describing that, John talks about the Antichrist in 1 John. And by the way, there are many Antichrists. John says there's not just one. There are many Antichrists. But how many people have taken their misunderstanding of the Antichrist and identified that as one person who's going to be there at the end of time and Jesus is going to come and destroy him? And so how many of our presidents have been identified as the Antichrist? And so some of them can be quite comical. Do you think Paul was really writing about a U.S. president, centuries down the line? I mean, how arrogant are we to think? But so some of them are quite comical. Some of them have some real strength and validity to their idea. There are some individuals that are very scholarly, individuals that I respect a lot, who identify the man of lawlessness as the Roman Catholic Church, or by the Pope, a Pope, or a line of popes. And that's probably one of the more common ideas, is that there was the falling away that would transpire with the establishment and the coming of the Catholic Church, and that was involved. And that's one of the more common ideas among some. It's got a lot of strength. If you go and study that particular position, it's got a lot of strength to it. I have a hard time believing that Paul was saying Jesus isn't going to come for 600 years. That's when the Catholic Church is established in the early 7th century. And so is Paul saying, don't worry about it, he's not going to come for 600 years. That seems to be a stretch. And I know he's not saying that in those kind of words, but that seems to be difficult. Others have looked at it, and instead of trying to identify a particular person, have thought maybe Paul is just talking about evil being personified. Not a particular person, but maybe it's just talking about evil itself being personified and being put into a person, calling this person the man of lawlessness, but it's just talking about evil in and of itself. And that could be the case. There are some that I love and respect who have thought maybe it's Judaism, or maybe it's the Roman Empire. And then who is it that's restraining? Whoever this man of lawlessness is, who is it that's restraining the man of lawlessness? And again, you see the variety of options and things that people have come up with. And as I stated at the beginning of class, we're not here this morning for me to try to identify who it is. Because there's a lot of different ideas out there. And not that we determine what we believe based upon what the ideas are. But let me see if I can show you what we do know. Okay, here's what we do know. When Paul wrote to the church at Thessalonica, they knew exactly what he was talking about. They knew who exactly he was talking about. That's why I said in verse 5 is a key. Do you not remember that when I was still with you, I was, the word told there is not just one time, it is a repeated action in the past, I was repeatedly telling you these things. Did they know? Yeah, that's what he says in verse 6. And now you know what is restraining. The word know there is the idea of a perfect knowledge that has been conveyed to you. You have a perfect understanding of this. They knew exactly what he was... So, in other words, since they knew, he did not have to go into further details for them. He did not have to continue to divulge the fullness of the identity of the man of lawlessness or the one who was restraining him, because they already had this understanding. But why doesn't God give it to us? Why doesn't God put it there for us? Why doesn't he put it in the Bible so that at least we today can understand it? Well, is it likely that if he doesn't identify him specifically for us, that we don't need to know? That it is not something that we have to have an understanding about? The reality is we don't know who the man of lawlessness is, who the man of sin is, or the one that was restraining him. And so for us to be dogmatic about it and say, this is who it is, I don't think we can be in that kind of a position. But there are some that have tried to put this down here as a future individual. Eschatology is just the study of final things. And so there are some who have tried to say that this, in their mind, is like an Antichrist individual that is going to come right before Jesus returns. And so they spend all of their time trying to identify who this is. But if we needed to know who this was, I want you to think about, because the specificity of these identities was known to the brethren, but it's not to us, can we conclude that these events precede Jesus, precede us? Can we, if we don't need to know who it is, if it doesn't have to be identified for us, could we conclude that these things have already transpired? That this is not something that's going to happen in our lifetime. This is something that has already happened. Something that they would already have known about back then. If it was something that we needed to know about, perhaps we would have more details about it. But in all likelihood, this is something that has transpired already before we got here. And so when we look at it, we are no longer waiting for something to occur before Jesus comes back. That's what he was telling this church. This church thought, boy, Jesus had already come back. And he says to them in verses 2 and 3, he hasn't come back. What has to come first? The falling away has to come first. By the way, look in 1 Timothy chapter 4 for just a minute. And we could look at several passages along this line. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, now the Spirit expressly says that in latter times some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. What did he say was going to happen? Latter times some will depart from the faith. Go over to 2 Timothy. Look in 2 Timothy chapter Well, let's just do chapter 4. There's a couple verses in chapter 3, but for sake of time, just look in chapter 4. 2 Timothy chapter 4 is where Paul tells Timothy in verse 2 to preach the word. And then in verse 3, he says, here's why it is so important that the word of God be preached. 2 Timothy 4 and verse 3. For the time will come when individuals will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers. And they will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables. But while I'm thinking about it, go to Acts chapter 20. Just tie all of these verses together. 1 Timothy 4, 2 Timothy 4, Acts chapter 20. You know Acts 20 and verse 28, where Paul was talking to the Ephesian elders, and he told them to shepherd the flock of God among which the Holy Spirit had made them overseers. And then he says in verse 29, he's talking to these elders from the church at Ephesus in Acts 20 and verse 29. And he says, for I know this, that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. And from among yourselves, men will rise up, speaking perverse things, to draw away the disciples after themselves. What do all of these passages have in common? What are they saying? Something is going to happen in the not too distant future where false teachers, Joyce says, where false teachers come along and lead people away from the truth. 1 Timothy chapter 4 said that in latter times some will depart from the faith. 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 3 said that the time is going to come where they won't listen to sound doctrine anymore. They're going to want false teachers who will teach them what they want to hear. And here's Paul saying in Acts chapter 20, chronologically, Acts 20 is after 1 and 2 Thessalonians have been written. 1 and 2 Thessalonians are written back in chapter 18 time. This is after, he's on his third missionary journey. This is after that time, but he's still saying to these individuals, the time is going to come where false teachers come among you and they lead individuals away from the truth. Could that be, come back to 2 Thessalonians, could that be what Paul was talking about in the falling away? That there was going to come a time in the not too distant future, apparently, to them, where individuals were going to be led away from the truth, they were going to fall away and leave the faith. And so what does he tell them? He tells them that what they need to do for down here at the bottom, what they needed to do is to be calm. That's why he's writing this to them. Remember verse 2, verses 1 and 2. I don't want you to be shaken. I don't want you to be troubled. And I don't want you to be deceived. Well, what's the opposite of that? I want you to be calm. I want you to be reassured about the second coming. Why? Because there were false teachers out there teaching them some things that were not right. And he says, but as he writes these things, while this is in the Bible for our benefit, we need to be ready. Because if these things have already transpired, which it seems that they have, then what's the next thing that's going to take place? Second coming of Jesus. When's that going to happen? Compare 1 Timothy chapter 5. What did he say in 1 Thessalonians. What did he say in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 in verse 2? That the day of the Lord comes as what? As a thief in the night. Is Jesus going to come at an hour that we do not expect him to come? Yes, he is. And so our responsibility is simply to be ready. There are some things about this passage we don't know. And some of you know Deuteronomy 29 and verse 29. And it's a verse we need to understand that when God doesn't reveal everything to us, we don't need to go digging for it. Secret things belong unto the Lord. But things that have been revealed to us, they belong to us. We are responsible for those things. But if there are some things that the Lord has not seen fit to identify and to reveal completely to us, then I don't believe it's up to us to try to be dogmatic about it or to try to force something to be there, but to just read what it says. And the first question, here's a key to Bible interpretation. First question you have to ask in Bible interpretation when you come and read a passage like this is, what did it mean to them? Before you ever say, what does it mean to me? What did it mean to them? They knew specifically who and what Paul was talking about. And here's the key. Look down in verse 9 and 10. We need to finish this chapter and we've got 6 minutes to do it. What is he saying to them? The problem here is that this one is coming along trying to deceive you. He's trying to lead away people. Verse 10 says he's trying to lead people away who do not receive the love of the truth. Can you be led away if you don't have a love for the truth? That's what he's saying. If you've got a love for the truth, it can lead you to be saved. But if you don't have a love for the truth, you can be led astray. Verse 11, for this reason, because it's really up to them whether they're going to love the truth or not. For this reason, and since they had decided not to love the truth, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie. Why would God send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie? He did that because they made the decision not to love the truth. And when they decided not to love the truth, what was God going to allow them to believe? The falsehood. The lie. That, verse 12, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth. And we'll see truth again in verse 13. That's a key in this passage. They didn't have a love for the truth, verse 10. They did not believe the truth, verse 12. And they did not have pleasure in unrighteousness, the end of verse 12. And so since they didn't care anything about the truth and didn't care anything about righteousness, God was going to allow them to believe something that was not true. Been a lot of people that have been looked at that passage and said, why would God do that? Why would God allow somebody to believe something that was a lie?
They've already decided to not believe the truth.
That's it. They had made the decision. God was not forcing something on them. Has God given every person free will? Yes. God was not taking their free will away. They had made the choice. And their choice was, we don't care anything about the truth. Is God going to say, no, 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 you got to come back. Come here, come here, come here, come here, come here. You got to believe the truth. Sit down, we're going to have a talk, and we're going to sit here until you believe the truth. Did you ever do that with your kids? Kids trying to do something. Come here, we're going to sit down, and we're going to sit here until you understand the truth about this, which can be a long time, and until you agree with me. You ever try that with your spouse? Until you agree with me, we're going to sit here and talk. How'd that work out for you? Does God do that? Does God say, oh, no, you don't, come here, come here. We're going to sit down, and I'm going to convince you of this, and we're going to sit here until you are convinced. Or, if somebody makes their choice to not believe the truth, what does he do? He's going to let them believe. He's going to let them believe the lie. And this sometimes comes up when you read about Pharaoh in the book of Exodus, and you read statements where it says, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And that's troublesome. Why would God harden Pharaoh's heart? You know what's also stated in those same chapters? Pharaoh hardened his heart against God. Well, which one was it? Pharaoh exercised his free will against God. Said, I don't want to have anything to do with this God. Was God going to force him to have his heart softened toward him? Or was God going to use that as an opportunity to free his people? He used that as an opportunity. You know, sometimes we think about God and we think that, we think that if God would have us just a little bit to follow him, that would be good enough. And what I'm thinking about is Revelation chapter 3. What did Jesus say about those who were hot and those who were cold and those who were lukewarm? Would Jesus rather you be semi-warm or cold? That's kind of strange. Jesus would rather you be cold than be semi-warm? I mean, semi-warm is sort of close to being hot, right? Does God want you sort of close to being hot for him? No. He'd rather you be frozen cold. Why? Well, partly because of our influence that we have, partly because of the life that we live, and mostly because he wants us to love him with all of our heart, not part of it. And so he wants all of us. Here were individuals, and we got to close this. Here were individuals who had not received a love for the truth. That was their choice. And God was not going to force them to do something against their decision. Romans 1 is another place we could look, where it talks about God gave them up to vile passions. God gave them over to their debased mind. Why would God do that? Well, read the chapter. He did it because they made the choice. They made the choice to worship the creature rather than the Creator. And when they made the choice, God allowed them to go and to live after their choices and their decisions. The end of this chapter is awesome. We just don't have time to get to it. Maybe we'll try to pick it up at the beginning of next week. But read through this. Read through chapter 3, and we'll finish this book next Sunday. Thank you all for your good attention today.